8, 6, 1, 0.
Welcome to the Radio Art Hour, a show where art is not just on the radio, but is the radio.
Oh, radio, radio. Uh-huh. Radio.
The Radio Art Hour draws from the Wavefarm Broadcast Radio Art Archive, an online resource that aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary international radio artworks made by artists around the world. Created specifically for terrestrial AM/FM broadcast. Whether it be by commercial, public, community, or independent transmission. Come on a journey with us as radio artists explore broadcast radio space through poetic resuscitations and playful celebrations, subversions of the complex relationship between senders and receivers in this hour of radio about radio. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the Radio Art Hour and Wavefarm's Radio Art Archives.
99. I'm Tom Rowe at the Wave Farm in upstate New York, where we work with artists that work with the radio waves. Wave Farm recently added the audio archives of New American Radio and some of their works from the late 80s and early 1990s. Today we will hear two of those works, Julie Drizin's After Roe, a blend of documentary and fiction about the past before Roe versus Wade was decided and the future. Also from the New American Radio archives, we will hear David Moss and his work Conjure, an audio piece based on an Italo Calvino text. And we're going to hear a radio opera from Jason Cady, his Candy Corn, told in reverse chronology on the Radio Art Hour.
Welcome to New American Radio, a series exploring new territories for the art of radio.
In its 10 years as a weekly national series from 1987 to 1998, New American Radio commissioned and distributed over 300 original works. Conceptual new drama, associational documentary, language explorations, sonic meditations, environmental compositions, musical explorations, and works that pioneer new dimensions in acoustic space. Wave Farm is thrilled to partner with New American Radio to ensure these works remain available to listeners today and into the future. New American Radio was organized by Helen Thorrington, executive producer, and Regina Beyer, associate producer. A special thanks to both Helen Thorrington and Joanne Green for their generous support and collaboration in this partnership. Up next is After Roe by Julie Drizin. Thank you for listening.
I had separated from my husband a second time, and I found myself pregnant, and I could not afford to have the child for different reasons, economic, emotional reasons, and I knew I had to have an abortion. I went to Baltimore and went into this motel room, and I gave this woman my $500, and without any anesthetic, this, I suppose, what would be called a D&C was performed on me. He told me what to do. I did it. It was performed in very short order. It was excruciatingly painful, of course. I was dismissed from the room, drove all the way back to Philadelphia, and for about a week suffered from a horrible infection, from which I probably could have died. Of course, I couldn't go to the hospital, or I was afraid to go to the hospital to have anything done. Because in those days, this was an arrestable offense. It was terribly painful, and my abdomen swelled up enormously, and a couple of friends came over and wanted to know what they could do, and I said, I don't know what to do. Fortunately, it subsided. All I know is that I was quite ill and very frightened because I thought I might die. I probably could have. Really, I was luckier than some of my friends who ended up in basements, almost literally back alleys. It's just an experience that no one should have to undergo. It's obscene and insane. It was just sheer terror. I was absolutely terrified. It was so painful. I was afraid I'd get caught. I don't know. It was just so horrible that I still see myself on that bed in that motel room. I don't see the doctor. I don't think I really saw the doctor. But I still see myself there.
This is Julie Drizin reporting live from Washington. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the death of Roe v. Wade, the controversial Supreme Court decision which legalized abortion in 1973. Since last year, the majority of states have banned abortion outright. In this half hour, we'll look at a year in the life of America after Roe. But first, as we speak, the president and an audience of his supporters are marking this anniversary with the unveiling of a national monument in memory of the estimated 28 million unborn children whose lives ended in abortion during the reign of Roe v. Wade. The memorial is being dedicated on the same day that the administration will announce a renewed campaign for the Human Life Amendment. This 25-word amendment would grant fetuses equal protection under the U.S. Constitution and therefore would impose federal law making abortion illegal in all states and U.S. territories. The president's assistants have now unveiled the statue. It's a black marble cross standing 12 feet high, bearing the figure of a small white marble baby. There's a red rose covering its genital area and a golden halo around its head. Nathan Randall is with me. He's a longtime member of the Sacred Life Crusaders. Nathan, this must be a day you've been dreaming of for a long time.
To tell you the truth, Julie, I am just thrilled that the war against abortion is almost over and that we are winning. Like all wars in this country's proud and mighty history, we remember those who gave their lives so that justice would prevail in the end. In this case, millions of unborn babies, silently screaming, ripped apart limb by limb, their lives brutally sucked out of them,
taken
against their will from the safety of their mother's womb.
Thank you, Mr. Randall. Joining me now for a political analysis is Gene Hunt, the former director of the Elizabeth Blackwell Health Center for Women, which provided abortion services to women in Philadelphia for close to two decades. Gene, this whole event must be a shock to you. How did the right wing win this fight?
What they've done is very clever. They've been able to correctly realize that people feel things are falling apart and that family life is under attack. And they've given the wrong answer for why that has happened. They say it's happened because we women are, quote, abandoning the home. They say it's happening because we don't care about our children anymore, because we're selfish. They say that family life is falling apart because we have no morals and no values. They don't say that family life is falling apart because the economic basis which sustains families in this country has been destroyed by their agenda. They've kept people focused in the wrong direction. There's some systemic things that have to be done to help support women and children in this country. And the anti-abortion movement consistently supports politicians who won't do those things. They don't vote for daycare appropriations. They don't vote for, you know, nutrition programs for families once kids are born. They don't vote for job training and helping to get people off medical assistance. In fact, they vote to cut medical assistance benefits so that families live in appalling poverty in this country. So they have an agenda that goes two directions at the same time. And I think people in the anti-abortion movement are going to have to come to terms with what's happened because of the anti-abortion politicians that have been in leadership, both nationally and at the state level.
So where do you think the anti-abortion agenda will lead us?
I fear that we will end up with a system where younger and younger women will, for instance, be committing suicide, which is what in states, for instance, in Utah, among young Mormon women, there is a very high rate of suicide. And when you investigate that, it's young women who are pregnant, who cannot face. When you are born into a community where it is verboten to be pregnant, to be sexually active, if abortion is not available at all, as it is in Utah, very difficult to access, young women will kill themselves. So I see quite a bleak scenario. And it's not a speculative scenario. We've been there. It's not a question of what might happen. It's a question of what will happen.
As the White House celebrates the anniversary of perhaps its greatest victory, not all Americans are toasting the occasion. In the eyes of some, the real war over abortion is just beginning. Not far from the White House dedication, the Encampment for Women's Lives is having a ceremony of its own.
And the issue isn't the supposed life of the child. The issue is control. And I won't be controlled, and I won't be silent. I'm not angry, and I'm not a passive little girl who's going to cry and ask. I'm taking back my rights. Men respond to anger, not to tears. I'll give them anger.
And we recognize that abortion raises some ethical questions. But the question I put to you is, doesn't war raise some ethical questions? And doesn't poverty raise some ethical questions? And doesn't racism raise some ethical questions? I mean, why is it that abortion becomes the ethical question of our generation? And so that the issue then becomes, what is the issue? And the issue is about power, pure and simple. It is about women being able to say what happens to their lives. And believe me, if you think that that's a simple statement, try to live it. Because in the last 12 years, the backlash against women has been utterly profound.
One option for the rich woman, another for the poor. No dirty backroom butchers, we won't have that.
The women and men gathered here today are creating their own memorial to remember the thousands of women who've died from illegal abortions before Roe v. Wade and the hundreds who've died all over the U.S. in just the last year. This memorial is not made of granite or marble. It's made from wire hangers, knitting needles, and other dangerous tools women have used to try to end their own pregnancies. Half of the Philadelphia General Hospital Obstetrics and Gynecology Unit houses women in labor. The other half is women who didn't want to have babies, women who took dangerous steps to end their pregnancies. Dr. Lewis Gersley heads up this ward, where he tries to patch up the medical disasters of illegal and self-induced abortion.
Perhaps the worst case that I can remember was of a 22-year-old woman who came in. She was in what we call septic shock. She had no blood pressure, no pulse, was quite lucid mentally. But we worked on her for about 6 hours and did everything we could do, and finally decided that the only solution we had left was to try to do a hysterectomy. And she was on the gurney heading back to her room. I was walking down the hallway with her, holding her hand. And again, as so many septic shock patients are, she was mentally lucid, and she was saying, "Doctor, help me, I'm dying." And there was absolutely nothing more I could do, and before she ever made her bed, she died. And that is the sort of thing I never want to see again. I still have a picture of her uterus in my teaching files. It had a catheter all coiled up inside it, and was the whole wall of the uterus was replaced by multiple tiny abscesses and was just basically a bag of pus.
Since abortion was outlawed, hospitals like Philadelphia General have begun to experience an echo of the past. Before Roe v. Wade, illegal abortion was a leading cause of death of women of childbearing age. And the majority of women who died in their attempts to end unwanted pregnancies were African American and Latina. Today, with the help of more advanced medical care and antibiotics, fewer women are expected to die. But still, many arrive here too late to reverse the course of infection, too late to save their lives.
I have pictures in my files of kidneys of a woman who tried to abort herself with a Lysol douche and went right through the uterus into the abdomen and killed her kidneys. I have another picture of a woman who tried to abort herself with potassium permanganate and burned a hole in her vagina into the rectum and into the bladder. I've seen others where they have tried everything from coat hangers to bicycle and umbrella spokes to whatever you can think of that any woman can try.
Cocaine is the abortifacient of choice among young women.
Sean Tuohy directs the Greater Philadelphia Women's Medical Fund, which helps low-income women pay for abortions.
Even young women who don't do drugs, but they know from the street that cocaine is an abortifacient. Everybody knows that cocaine brings on early labor. So, you know, you could conclude from that that if you take enough of it, you'll miscarry. That happens sometimes. A lot of times it doesn't, and sometimes kids get hooked on drugs.
The new Planned Parenthood released its first radio commercial today.
Right after we got married, Ronnie and I knew we wanted to have children, but we had a lot of questions about pregnancy and childbirth and raising kids. That's when my friend Anita told me to visit Planned Parenthood. I said, Planned Parenthood? I thought that abortion mill was shut down. No, silly, she said, the new Planned Parenthood.
The new Planned Parenthood provides comprehensive family planning for married couples. We'll help you plan your pregnancies from start to finish and decide the number of children that's right for you. And we'll teach you the importance of raising your children in a disciplined Christian environment. All of these services and more at the new Planned Parenthood, because America's future begins in the womb. The new Planned Parenthood can be reached at 222-BABY. Call now for a free brochure on how breastfeeding your child can ruin your marriage. That's the new Planned Parenthood at 222-BABY.
Kathy Call joins me now. She's the head of the Delaware County Pro-Life Coalition, a group that fought the old Planned Parenthood's agenda by speaking out against abortion and birth control for teenagers.
We can say no to drugs, we can say no to alcohol, we can say no to sex. There's an idea in this society that you can take sex and separate it from having children, that sex is a right that people have, but that children is a consequence and should be eliminated. You can't do that. You can't take sex and separate it from having children. It wasn't meant to be like that. So I'm not saying that every time you have sex you should have a child, but I am saying that people who have sex outside of marriage are not using their sexual capacity in the way it was designed or in the way it best benefits them. And I don't think you have to take any religious idea and use it to back that up. Just take health. Just take what's happening with sexually transmitted diseases and AIDS and pregnancies when they're unplanned. There's a lot of problems because people haven't learned where sex belongs. I think women can control their reproductive lives. It means having sex when you should. In a family, in a marriage, in a committed marriage, having children, and then when you find out you're pregnant, you're full of joy and happiness. We're going to have a child.
But not all pregnancies are the result of consensual unions between two people in love. Most states still allow abortion in cases of rape and incest only if the woman files criminal charges within 24 hours of the incident. But the new Planned Parenthood tries to convince pregnant victims of these crimes to have their babies.
This is one of the most upsetting aspects of this whole thing. Rape is a horrible crime, and it should be punished. But it doesn't make sense to punish the innocent victim of a rape, which would be the woman, or her child, if a child is conceived. When it does result in pregnancy, the woman shouldn't be hurt further by being put under or being put through an abortion, which kills a child that's half hers. And neither should the innocent child be put to death for the crime of his or her father.
Kathy Call says that going through with the pregnancy and bearing the child can be part of a healing process which helps women recover from devastating tragedies like rape and incest. Since abortion became illegal, it has not stopped happening. Instead, it has moved underground and overground. A group of Quaker women founded the Overground Railroad after the Supreme Court's Webster decision signaled the beginning of the end for abortion rights.
Shortly after the decision was handed down and everyone became aware of it, women met at the Women's Center and were outraged and said, "Do we see the handwriting on the wall? Roe is going to be in big trouble, and we have to do something about it." And somebody said, "Well, Quakers were very successful in the last century with an underground railroad moving slaves from slave states to free states, and they saved a lot of slaves. And perhaps we could do the same thing with women who were in states where they couldn't get an abortion. Perhaps we could help them get to states where they could." And the idea was born. And the name Overground was decided because it's not illegal.
Legal or illegal, that's for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide. Either way, the women of the Overground Railroad pledged to continue their work.
For us, this is a religious witness. And when something is a religious witness, even if it's frightening, you feel that you have to do that because for you, it's the right thing to do. Quakers have done illegal acts before. Just because it's against the law doesn't mean it's right for it to be against the law. It's just a bad law. And people have a moral responsibility not to obey a bad law.
And that's why some women have learned how to do abortions for themselves. The procedure is called menstrual extraction, and it's a crime.
We're tired of having our bodies controlled by the male government and the male medical establishment. Men don't know what it's like to be pregnant. And look, abortion is a basic procedure, and you don't need a doctor or a lawyer or a politician to do it.
Jane is a member of a self-help group, a small circle of women who meet weekly to examine each other's reproductive systems, extract menstrual flow, and do low-tech abortions when necessary. Since Roe v. Wade was overturned, Jane's group has begun to do home abortions for other women in need.
We use something called the Del-M, which is basically an empty jar with a stopper and two plastic tubes. One tube goes to the cannula, and the other gets connected to a syringe with a one-way valve. From that point, we just slowly and gently move the cannula around the uterus and use a syringe to get the suction going to empty out what's in the uterus. And there are two important things to know. Women should not try this alone. They have to be taught in groups. And the other thing is that you can only do this procedure in the first 8 weeks of pregnancy.
The FBI, DEA, and FDA joined forces today in the largest abortion bust ever. The three agencies worked together to arrest two women who attempted to smuggle thousands of RU486, the controversial French abortion pill, into the United States. Ernest Friendly is with the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
We've been gathering intelligence on a local smuggling ring for the past 6 months, and these women, these girls, have been at the center of it. But they couldn't outsmart us. All right. They flew to Amsterdam 2 days ago, where they met up with some Dutch feminists who got the pills from some French feminists, and they flew back last night. It's a whole feminist conspiracy to break federal law, hon.
The arrest of these women signals the beginning of a highly orchestrated law enforcement campaign to keep Pennsylvania an abortion-free state. Seth Kramer is a constitutional law expert at the University of Pennsylvania. He says that before Roe, women who got abortions were rarely prosecuted.
That was, however, a less ideologically charged time. And again, one can imagine a ideological zealot in the district attorney's office deciding that since he believes that a fetus is a person, a woman who destroys her fetus is a murderer and hence subject to criminal penalties.
Kramer says that if the government uses its war on drugs as a model, we could wind up with informers, secret agents, surveillance, infiltration, and other cornerstones of a police state. While some of these scenarios might sound like science fiction, they have occurred elsewhere.
The most egregious case, of course, is the Irish situation of the 14-year-old girl who had been raped who was subject to an injunction that she not leave the country to obtain an abortion. We've seen Germany engage in searches of women, gynecological examinations under duress of women who returned from overseas. So one could imagine a sufficiently extremist state, or for that matter, local district attorney, deciding that he would obtain a search warrant to search women as they return from out of state. That's something I think that is a fairly hair-raising possibility, but we have seen similar things happen overseas.
Finally, last month, we uncovered perhaps the cruelest reality of post-abortion America: unwanted children. Since abortion was outlawed, estimates are that hundreds of thousands of unwanted babies will be available for adoption each year. Although the government has created financial incentives to adopt, with a glut of available newborns, less than perfect children in the adoption and foster care systems are left behind. So what happens to these kids? Our undercover news team found an orphanage the federal government would rather you not know about. We're at the site of a former military base near Philadelphia, which closed when the Cold War came to an end a few years ago. You may not have heard about this place, but it's better known among those who work here today as Camp Misery. It's called Camp Misery because hundreds of unwanted and unadoptable children are warehoused here. One orphanage worker was willing to talk to us so long as we didn't reveal her identity.
Why do we shave their heads? Because there are lice here. We have to keep their heads shaved to keep them from getting bugs in their hair. These kids are always sick. Outbreaks of childhood diseases. Let's see, we've already had mumps, chicken pox, measles, colds, anything. If one kid gets it, they all get it. There's never enough of anything here. We don't have enough food for these kids. Toys, you might as well forget it. Books, clothes. The kids even are jammed in two to a bed. It's cold here. It's damp. It's dark. You can see that for yourself. This is not a facility that was made for housing children.
About half of the kids here are Black or Latino. Many have congenital birth defects, psychological or behavioral problems, or learning disabilities. They range in age from newborns to teens, but most of the kids run away by age 13 if they can.
The kids are bored and frustrated here. It's easy to understand why. We're supposed to be educating them, but that is not possible. Look, there are 40 children to each worker. Some of them have incredible needs, and that means that most of them are ignored all day long. The kids are so unhappy. I feel the worst about that. A lot of them cry a lot of the time. The kids who don't cry get into violent fights with each other. Sometimes we have to sedate them just to keep them from killing each other.
Abortion kills children.
War kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Hunger kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Abuse kills children.
Abortion kills children.
AIDS kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Poverty kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Drugs kill children.
Abortion kills children.
Guns kill children.
Abortion kills children.
Bigotry kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Violence kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Neglect kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Hatred kills children.
Abortion kills children.
Bombs kill children.
Abortion kills children.
Ignorance kills children.
Abortion.
Abortion. Abortion. Abortion. Abortion.
You just heard After Roe by Julie Drizin, broadcast by New American Radio.
4, 4, 1, 6, 3. Noah, 5, 0, 0.
Next, we hear from sound artist Jason Cady and his radio opera Candy Corn, told in reverse chronology about a couple coming to terms with a loved one's suicide. can go to jasonkatiemusic.com for more information.
Damn pretty good, considering you forgot how to play.
I didn't say that. I said I never played Rummy 500.
But we played together before.
I don't remember.
Well, you know, as Andy said, forgetting is a form of dying.
What's that? One of his tweets? Or something he actually said?
I don't know what you get.
120, what you get?
80. Okay, so it's 420 to 360. Your lead, your deal.
You ever think of starting off? Moving out of the city, you know, whatever.
No, I'm pretty happy with our lives.
Really?
Yeah, why not? I mean, sure, things could get better, but throwing everything away.
What about just as a thought experiment?
Like, what if we were Russian spies?
No, I mean, what if I gave up singing and went back to school to become a social worker?
Oh, okay, I see.
But then I think I should keep my church gig because the pay is good.
Yeah, and it's just Sunday, so.
But then I think if a really good gig came along, I'd still take it.
Well, yeah, of course.
And I'd still write songs, so.
Wrong with that. It means you're satisfied with your life.
Well, maybe satisfaction is just a lack of imagination.
But change is inevitable anyway, right?
Yeah, but we shouldn't just let change happen to us.
You know what they say, man makes plans and God laughs.
Well, God sounds kind of like an asshole.
You should read his book, Total Asshole, petty and vengeful, created in our image.
And when I think about leaving the city, I imagine moving to Arizona to be closer to our families.
When was the last time you even talked with your parents?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking with my mom at all these days. So you really want to give up our apartment just to be near them?
I hate Arizona.
Yeah, me too.
Put your phone away.
Why?
Come on, we're hanging out.
I was just...
What a fun Halloween. Sitting at home in our pajamas, trying to play cards while you ignore me.
I was just looking at people's costumes on Instagram. Is it?
You know, suspenders, Converse, a wig, and a violin. It's Einstein on the beach.
Oh, cool. Is that someone you know in real life?
Yeah, remember we ran into her actually at the beach last year out in Fire Island.
I don't even remember going to the beach last summer.
We just went out for Labor Day. We had a few months after Andy died.
We shouldn't have come here.
We haven't been to the beach all summer. We have to move on with our lives.
I know. That's what everyone says. And he hated the beach.
Only because he couldn't get Wi-Fi.
Can we not trash talk him?
I'm not. But can we get real for a second? What he did was really fucked up.
I know.
I didn't even know you could automate.
That's why it seemed like he was always tweeting, even if he was actually out doing stuff.
I had no idea.
Yeah, well, it wasn't exactly the same as scheduling the tweets to come out after he had killed himself.
Do you think he was deliberately tricking us to try to save him after he had already died?
I don't know. I don't think he was trying to hurt us. I think he was just being dramatic.
It was cruel and spiteful.
It was selfish. But I don't think he was trying to get some kind of sick revenge.
Yeah, well, some of those things he wrote were pretty fucking mean.
He was in pain. I just don't get why he did it. I know he wasn't happy, but
I think he was having an argument with the universe and wanted to have the final word.
He was so creative, but he lost his way. He should have been making stuff.
Yeah.
I think he felt like a failure. He couldn't reconcile his online popularity with the grind of his daily life.
Yeah, maybe it makes me want to cut social media out of my life.
Yeah, me too. Look at that guy over there. He's at the beach and he's looking at his phone.
How pathetic.
It just alienates us. We can't have real experiences anymore.
Everyone's so detached
and snarky. You can't have serious conversations anymore.
I've talked with my parents.
Popular kids liked him.
But he still hung out with misfits like you.
Yeah, he was the best friend I ever had. I keep thinking about every fight I ever had with him. And it all seems so petty now. I wish I could tell him I loved him. I can tell some people think I should be over it by now. Like they were sympathetic at first, but now they're acting like
bullshit! Fuck them!
Will we ever get over this?
No, but it won't always be this bad. And I don't think it's linear. It comes and goes in waves.
It fades like a sandcastle. About some more beach metaphors.
I love you.
And he didn't have anyone.
He had us and millions of Twitter followers.
I think that was the problem.
I just wish he'd reached out to us.
Yeah, we could have talked.
I keep trying.
On some kind of downward spiral for a while.
Yeah, but there were good times too. We have to remember the good times. Like last Halloween when we all went out to that costume party. Andy was so
texted, he's running late.
He better get his ass here soon, or we're leaving without him.
Come on.
How many times has he tweeted in like the last hour?
Hey, check out his costume. That he started about digital ascension.
No, what's that?
I don't really get it exactly, but it's the idea that you could make your consciousness immortal by combining, what's the word, you know?
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's it, combining AI and linguistic analysis with a complete record of your thoughts and experiences through your social media data and whatever.
So, Andy wants to live forever, but like us, all won't.
Yeah, I guess.
Good luck with that.
Well, he also posted some music that was composed by artificial intelligence, but in the style of Bach, and it sounded authentic.
But that's different. Music follows rules.
Yeah, but don't composers break the rules?
No, they can't. Rules are procedures. You obtain a result from an operation. If you want a different result, you need a different operation. So you always follow rules, no matter what.
But not every composer follows the same rules.
Yeah, exactly.
But if the algorithms were super complex and the data was comprehensive, then why couldn't something like that be achieved for human consciousness?
I just don't believe in disembodied thoughts or like identity.
About generating new thoughts digitally from your previous thoughts.
Like shifting a deck of cards to play another round of Rummy.
Well, sort of.
I mean, yeah, I get what you're saying. I hate having a body. I feel like a zombie. I hate having to eat and having all these disgusting bodily functions.
Yeah. Imagine if we could just be.
But look, Andy would not be Andy if he was tall and good looking, or if he was from a wealthy family, or born in another country, or another time, or if he was a woman, you know.
Yeah.
Or if he didn't have clinical depression.
I hate it when people call it clinical depression. No one ever said clinical cancer.
It's like this candy corn, you know. They take corn and turn it into corn syrup and then add food coloring, and it becomes candy corn, and it's totally unhealthy and tastes like shit.
Okay, but let's say I eat one of these candy corns. Say this is the same bowl of candy corn.
Sure, why not?
But then what if I replaced the candy corn I ate with one from another bag, and like kept replacing them one by one as I ate them? At what point, if any, does it become a different bowl of candy corn?
Yeah. That's gross.
I kind of like candy corn.
Dude, this is literally left over from last year because we didn't eat it.
That makes it even better. I don't even remember what we did last year. Did we go out? What were our costumes?
I think we just sat at home.
Вот трей, нова, нова, трей. Шепте, нова, зеро, шепте, шепте. Уно, чинч, шепте, шепте, шасе. Чинч, вот, дой, шасе, шепте. Трей, зеро, чинч, патру, трей.
Welcome to New American Radio, a series exploring new territories for the art of radio.
In its 10 years as a weekly national series from 1987 to 1998, New American Radio commissioned and distributed over 300 original works. Conceptual new drama, associational documentary, language explorations, sonic meditations, environmental compositions, musical explorations, and works that pioneer new dimensions in acoustic space. Wave Farm is thrilled to partner with New American Radio to ensure these works remain available to listeners today and into the future. New American Radio was organized by Helen Thorington, executive producer, and Regina Beyer, associate producer. A special thanks to both Helen Thorington and Joanne Green for their generous support and collaboration in this partnership. Up next is Conjure by David Moss. Thank you for listening.
Nobody looks at the moon in the afternoon.
Right, that's how long it takes. Not a day less.
Once as I went past,
I drew a sign at a point in space, just so I could find it again. 200 million years later. When we went by, come on, next time around.
In identifying a constellation, the decisive proof is to see how it answers when you call it.
What sort of sign?
I don't know. It's hard to explain because kind of hard. If I say sign.
To you,
you immediately think of a something that can be distinguished
from a something else. But nothing could be distinguished from anything there.
The universe, collection of celestial bodies, nebulas, fine dust, force fields, intersections of fields, collections of collections.
You immediately think of a sign. You immediately think of a sign.
May we
implement.
Or with your hands.
Take a matzah,
and then
when you
take
the implement, when you take that, or your hands away, how that sign remains. But in those days,
there were no
implements or even hands.
All things that came along afterwards. A long time afterwards.
Today, the situation is more serious, and the remedies must be more extreme. The plastic arts have already faced the problem of establishing erotic communication with the materials and objects of our most humdrum everyday lives.
As to the form,
a sign
should have.
I don't know. You
say it's no problem because
whatever form may be
given, it only has to serve as a sign.
In identifying a constellation, the decisive proof is to see how it answers when you call it.
Here again, it's easy for you young ones to talk.
But in that period, I have to know because of the examples. Nothing.
Chuchiacha, chuchacha, euch, 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 euch. And the men flamla. I wouldn't know the men it was
to follow. Yeah. I couldn't say. I'll make it the same, or I'll make it different.
There were no things to copy.
Nobody knew how what a line was. Straight or curved, or even a dot, or a protuberance, or a cavity. I can see the idea of making a sign. That's true enough. Or rather, I can see the idea of making a sign. Something I felt like making.
What a line was, straight or curved, or even a dot, or a protuberance, or a cavity.
So where?
Poison space.
Not in another.
Meaning to make a sign. Sign. It turned out
I really had made a sign
after all.
And so now, after 500 million years have gone by, I look around and above that rock, I see a railway embankment and a train passing along it with a party of Dutch girls looking out of the window. And in the last compartment, a solitary traveler reading Herodotus in a bilingual edition. And the train vanishes into the tunnel under the highway, where there is a sign with the pyramids and the words, "Visit Egypt." And a little ice cream wagon tries to pass a big truck, but then it puts its brakes on because its visibility is blocked by a cloud of bees. which crosses the road coming from a row of hives in a field from which surely a queen bee is flying away. Drawing behind her a swarm in the direction opposite to the smoke of the train, which has reappeared at the other end of the tunnel, so you can see hardly anything thanks to the cloudy stream of bees and coal smoke. Except a few yards farther up, there is a peasant breaking the ground with his mattock, and unaware, he brings to light and reburies a fragment of a Neolithic mattock similar to his own. In a garden that surrounds an astronomical observatory with its telescope aimed at the sky, and on whose threshold the keeper's daughter sits reading the horoscopes in a weekly whose cover displays the face of the star of Cleopatra. I see all this and feel no amazement, because making the sign implied also making the honey in the wax comb, and the coal, and the telescopes, and the reign of Cleopatra, and the films about Cleopatra, and the pyramids, and the design of the zodiac of the astrologers, and the wars and empires Herodotus speaks of, and the words written by Herodotus. And so I feel as if, in making the sign, I had also made the rest.
Nobody looks at the moon in the afternoon.
You just heard Conjure by David Moss, broadcast by New American Radio.
That was the Radio Art Hour, mostly put together from the work of Wave Farm Radio Art Fellows Jess Speer and Karen Werner. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the radio art you heard featured on the Radio Art Hour.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.